So this reading is John 14, verses 1 through 14. Do not let your hearts be troubled. Trust in God. Trust also in me. In my Father's house are many rooms. If it were not so, I would have told you. I am going there to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me, so that you may be where I am. You know the way to the place where I am going. Thomas said to him, Lord, we don't know where you're going, so how can we know the way? And Jesus answered, I am the way and the truth and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. If you really knew me, you would know my Father as well. From now on, you do know him, and you have seen him. Philip said, Lord, show us the Father, and that will be enough for us. And Jesus answered, Don't you know me, Philip? Even after I have been among you such a long time, anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, show us the Father? Don't you believe that I am the Father and that the Father is in me? The words I say to you are not just my own. Rather, it is the Father living in me who is doing his work. Believe me when I say that I am the Father and the Father is in me. Or at least believe on the evidence of the miracles themselves. I tell you the truth. Anyone who has faith in me will do what I have been doing. He will do even greater things than these because I am going to the Father. And I will do whatever you ask in my name, so that the Son may bring glory to the Father. You may ask me for anything in my name, and I will do it.
So I'm Sam Edgen. This is the first time I'm going to be speaking here, but I'm on staff here at the Mercy House. I direct the internship, as well as run the coffee bar and do a whole bunch of other things, like speaking on Sunday, which is what I'm doing right now. So, can't say so. Rachel is helping with that. All right, we are in John 14. I'm going to twist this maybe a little bit, not twist the passage, but the way that I'm going is probably not what you would expect when you first read this. So in John 14, I'm going to be focusing in on 14:1, which says, do not let your hearts be troubled, trust in God, trust also in me. 14:5, which says, Thomas said to him, Lord, we do not know where you are going, so how can we know the way? And then 8 through 14, it says, Philip said, Lord, show us the Father, and that will be enough for us. Jesus answered, don't you know me, Philip, even after I have been among you such a long time? Anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, show us the Father? Don't you believe I am in the Father and that the Father is in me? The words I say to you are not just my own. Rather, it is the Father living in me who is doing his work. Believe me when I say that I am in the Father and the Father is in me. Or at least believe on the evidence of the miracles themselves. I tell you the truth. Anyone who has had faith in me will do what I have been doing. He will do even greater things than these because I am going to the Father. And I will do whatever you ask in my name, so that the Son may bring glory to the Father. You may ask me for anything in my name, and I will do it. But in addition to these passages, these verses here, I'm also going to be looking a little bit at Matthew 27, 45 through 53, somewhere in there. We'll look at it in a little bit later. But if you want to get your thumb in Matthew 27 as well. That might help if you have a Bible. Okay, so what I'm going to be talking about to you guys today, going from this passage, maybe taking almost the opposite of that, but I'll connect it a little bit. I want to talk to you about the possibility of turning doubting our faith, doubting our beliefs, doubting what we know, into something of a spiritual discipline, which sounds a little weird. I understand that. But before you chase me out that door up right there, in addition to that, I want to talk about what it would mean because of our doubt and because of the way we exercise doubt to be faithers and not believers. Now, this all sounds a little bit confusing, so I need to define what I mean by some of these terms first. So in this passage, the disciples are asking Jesus questions. And Jesus is saying things like, you need to trust me. He's saying things like, believe in me. And the disciples keep asking questions because they want proof. They want Jesus to say, here is empirical evidence that what I'm telling you is true, so it'll be okay and you can believe everything that you want. And it won't be any problems for you at all. But Jesus doesn't really give them that. So really what we're talking about in this passage are three things, at least that I want to pull out. I want to pull out one, that Jesus is talking about belief. He says the word believe a lot. I also want to say that Jesus is talking about faith. I want to equate trust and faith. But because these disciples are asking questions like this, because they're saying, hey, we don't know, so can you tell us? I also want to talk about doubt. I'm going to be focusing a lot on that. So let's start with belief. In our contemporary Christian culture, what we see a lot when we talk about belief is this idea that belief is this supposedly unwavering insistence that something is true, whether we can prove it or not. I believe that the sky is blue, but I might be colorblind. So maybe the sky is yellow. Let me give you an example of how our culture does this. So I work, in addition to working at the church, I lay flooring. And there was a house that we were working in once. And sometime throughout the day, I realized that I needed to use the bathroom. So I walked into the bathroom of this house. And sitting on the wall was a picture. But it was a picture that just had words on it. And what the words said were, faith is the assurance of things that we cannot see but are true. Now, if that brings up question marks in anybody, that's a good reason, because that's a really rough paraphrase of Hebrews 1:11, which says, faith is the confidence in what we hope for and the assurance of things we do not see. Now, if you notice, that picture added something to the verse. The picture added, but that are true. Because we insist that if we believe something, we have to believe that it's true. And we have to be certain in that, or else there's something wrong with us. So, for the purposes of this talk that we're having right now, what I want to do is I want to define belief as that. The contemporary belief that we insist something is true if we can't prove it, and we have to rely on that. And we lean on that, and we say, you know, I believe this, so it's true. And if you tell me that it's not true, we've got a problem, because it is true. And I don't really like that. So instead, what I want to do is I want to redefine what we mean by faith, at least for what we're doing here. What I'm going to do is I'm going to use a definition, roughly a definition, that Peter Rollins gives for faith. Now, Peter Rollins is an Irish philosopher and theologian. He wrote a bunch of books. One of them is The Fidelity of Betrayal. One of them is The Orthodox Heretic. He started an experimental Christian collective called Icon. But he writes that when we're talking about faith, we're not talking about what I just defined as belief, but instead what we're talking about is this idea that when we have faith, we are wrapping ourselves so much in a story and this underlying narrative of our lives that that narrative shapes everything about who we are. And it changes the way that we live our lives each day. Faith is letting a narrative change us so much, whether we know it's true or not, that we then live our lives according to it, no matter what our doubts are. Now let me help explain this. I do some nerdy things sometimes, so I've been watching a TV show called Battlestar Galactica, which sounds ridiculously nerdy when you talk about it. Now I'm gonna explain a little bit more about it, and you guys are gonna think it's even more nerdy. But it's really good. Now, in this TV show, humans have been chased off their home planet, and they are living in spaceships on the run from robots that they created called Cylons. Are you guys still with me? Because it's getting kind of weird. Now, they're basically in this war. The Cylons are trying to kill the humans are trying to kill the Cylons. But what happens is there's this one robot. The robots can look like humans. They've developed this technology so that they look and talk and everything like humans. So there's this one that they capture as a prisoner in the beginning of the show, or close to the beginning of the show. And I'm going to try not to spoil things for you. See what happens. So they capture this Cylon as a prisoner. And as the show progresses, she becomes more and more a part of the human crew. She ends up marrying a human. They end up enlisting her in the human army. And the commander of the human army, through being with her for extended periods of time, develops a really close friendship with this girl. Now remember that this is someone who, at the very core of them, is the enemy of everything that the humans are. Now, there's this one point in the show where this character is assigned as a part of the human army to go on a mission against her kind, against the robots. And her role in this mission completely defines the fate of all of humanity. What she does defines whether humanity will survive or not, basically. So they get ready to go, and she's about to get on this ship. She turns around, she looks at the commander of the human military or whatever. His name's Commander Adama, and he's like one of the main characters. She looks at him, and she says, how do you know? I mean, how do you really know that you can trust me? Because she might turn on him at any time to save her race. And he looks at her and he says, I don't. That's what trust is. So what I'm saying by that and what I'm trying to get at is that we need to recognize that we are unable to know a lot of things, especially things about God, about other people, about where we're placing our trust. But because of that uncertainty that we have, trust is all the more potent, because we have to choose to trust in light of what we don't know, in light of realizing that, no, we don't know this. So what I want to say is that in deciding to trust, or to faith, as Peter Rollins describes it, defined apart from belief, which is the assistance that things are true, we make this conscious choice to engage with something, and what I'm talking about engaging with here is an underlying narrative, that thing, that story that defines who we are. We're making a choice to engage so completely in light of any doubts that we have. And what I want to suggest is that this is what Christ is asking of his disciples in verse 1. He says, you trust in God, trust also in me. He's saying that despite all these questions that you're about to ask, despite any problems that you have right now, I want you to trust me. Because you can't know. But I want you to choose to anyway. So I was just talking a lot about doubt. And that's the third thing that I want to dive into a little bit and define before we move on to other things. Now, doubt is something that's really difficult to talk about in church. Doubt is that thing in most churches where you go in and if you say, hey, I don't know about this. I'm not sure what I think about that. I don't know if God exists. Let's just use that one. If you say that in church, everyone around you looks at you kind of weird. Or at least you feel like they do. Because when you're expressing doubt, you're saying, well, my belief isn't strong enough. And that's belief as I defined it before, the insistence that things are true. So you're saying, well, my belief isn't strong enough. And everybody else around looks at you and they're like, why isn't your belief strong enough? What's wrong with you? Why can't you believe enough? Why don't you believe more so that you don't doubt? And I don't like that. That puts a lot of pressure on us to try to determine something that we can't. Because like I was talking about before, there's some things we cannot know empirically. It's just impossible. So is doubt really quite as bad as most of the contemporary church would have you believe? Here's the part where we're going to look at Matthew 27, like I talked about before. You guys can turn there if you'd like. This is at the moment of crucifixion. I'm going to start in verse 45. And it says, from the sixth hour until the ninth hour, darkness came over all the land. About the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani, which means, my God, why have you forsaken me? When some of those standing there heard this, they said, he's calling Elijah. Immediately, one of them ran and got a sponge. He filled it with wine vinegar, put it on a stick, and offered it to Jesus to drink. The rest said, now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to save him. And then Jesus cried out again in a loud voice. He gave up his spirit. Now what I want to focus on in that passage is Jesus Christ's cry. When he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? Now, in Greek, this word that's translated here, forsaken, this word is enkataleipo, which is kind of weird to roll off the tongue. But in other versions, other than the one that I just read, your version might say it, this word is translated abandoned. But not, it's not always just translated abandoned. In other places in the Bible and other literary sources, it's translated things like to leave helpless, or even to abandon to Hades or hell. So in this moment, with this cry, Christ is saying, God, where did you go? Why are you gone? Why don't I believe in you right now? Because I really need you. And you are not here at all. Christ is questioning God's total desertion of him and the time where he needed him most. It's expressing a lot of doubt. And this is a pattern that we see that Christ is following through all of the passion, which is the events leading up to his death. Now, in the Garden of Gethsemane, when Christ went to pray alone, he prayed to God and he said, take this cup from me because I don't want to do this. I don't like this. This sounds terrible. I have to go die for all these people that I don't even know. This is stupid. Can we do something else, please? It didn't happen. And here on the cross, he says, why? I didn't even want to do this. And now that I've done it, you're gone. What am I supposed to do with this? I think that here Christ is setting an example of how we all as humans struggle with some really, really serious doubts. Where we say at times, God, I don't know where you are. I don't know if you're even there. And I want to suggest that Christ did the same thing. And as Christ set this example, there are others that followed. Let me read this for you for a second. This is somebody that wrote this. Since 49 or 50, this terrible sense of loss, this untold darkness, this loneliness, this continual longing for God, which gives me pain deep down in my heart, darkness such that I really do not see, neither with my mind nor with my reason. This place of God in my soul is blank. There is no God in me. When the pain of longing is so great, I just long and long for God, and this then it is how I feel. He does not want me. He is not here. Heaven, souls, while these are just words which mean nothing to me, my very life seems contradictory. I help souls to go where? Why all this? Where is the soul of my very being? God does not want me. Sometimes I hear my own heart cry out, my God, and nothing else comes. The torture and pain I cannot explain. Now this, what I just read, was written by Mother Teresa, who is perhaps the greatest example that we have of faithfulness in all of Christian history. She spent her entire life serving lepers in India. And for most of that time, this is how she felt. So what I want to highlight by that and by the suffering of Christ on the cross is this. We're never really going to get rid of doubt. It's always going to be there. It's always sitting there because the nature of what we're doing, engaging with the supernatural, we can't know. It's just not going to happen. But I don't think this is bad. And I think that because of this, because of this awareness of our inabilities, we can become something else, what Peter Rollins calls faithers instead of believers. Now let me dive into this a little bit. Let's go back to John. So I talked a little bit about how we use trust as faith. We're defining trust as faith, and that awareness of ourselves and our story as we're walking through this life. And this commitment to the story so much that it shapes who we are, even though we basically doubt everything that is going on with it. Even though we might say, I don't know if you're there, God. I have no idea. We still, every day, live within the story of Christ's reconciliation of all things to him. And I want to go and look at, in this passage, just for a second, the way that the disciples are questioning Christ. The disciples are saying, hey, give us proof. We have no idea. Tell us something. Show us God, which is really audacious for them to ask if you think about it. But these questions are a good thing. If it weren't for these questions, if it weren't for us asking questions, their questions allow Christ to give clarity to them. If they hadn't asked those questions, he wouldn't be able to explain anything. Now, the problem of being a believer, as I defined it earlier, is that you get so set in what you think and what you know that you stop asking questions. You stop saying, am I really right in this? And if something happens and you start to doubt a little bit, it destroys who you are because you've wrapped so much of yourself up in this thing that you believe, in this thing that has to be true, because why would you believe it if it isn't true, that if there's a little bit of evidence, a little bit of a reason to think, no, maybe it's not true, it starts to chip away at your identity. And that it hurts and it destroys us. But what I want to show you is that if we are faithers instead of believers, faithers, that is, people who are living for the narrative despite anything else, they're so committed that they live every day around that narrative. You're so immersed in this thing, despite whether it may be true or false. Now, this has to have both belief and doubt wrapped up in it, because those things are still important. You still have to have things that you believe. We can't descend into ultimate nihilism. You have to think something. But what I want to say is that we faith that is living for the story. We faith independent of our ideas on the truth or falsehood regarding what we think. Let me talk about this a little. I'm going to read you a little bit from C.S. Lewis' book, The Screwtape Letters. Now, I don't know how many of you guys have read this or anybody knows anything about it. It's a really good book. But basically, C.S. Lewis writes this entire book from the perspective of a demon who is teaching another demon how to tempt humans and pull them away from God. So basically, he's writing this whole book as the villain. And this passage that I'm going to read you right now is from the viewpoint of the villain. Now, C.S. Lewis writes here, this is Screwtape talking, "Do not be deceived. Our cause is never more in danger than when a human, no longer desiring but still intending to do our enemy's will, looks round upon a universe in which every trace of him is Christ, our God, in which every trace of him seems to have vanished, and asks why he has been forsaken and still obeys." Now, this right here is part of the main force of what I'm trying to talk about today. This doubt that we have, this questioning of our beliefs, questioning of everything that we think, it serves us as a couple things. Now, first, it serves us as a refinement, kind of like tempering a sword. You put something in the heat and pull it out again to make it stronger. It gives us a constantly renewed assurance that, yes, we are choosing to shape our lives to a story, and that we are still doing that even though we don't believe some things about that story at that particular moment, even though we have some pretty severe questions about it. And this doubt defines our faith as strong, which is the opposite of what so much of contemporary Christianity would have us believe, that doubt is showing that your belief is weak. But when we doubt and continue to live for that story, even though we're doubting parts of it, we are showing that, no, I'm really part of this. I'm so wrapped up in it that I can't get out of it, even though I'm not sure about it. And that says something really, really significant about who we are. This doubt propels us to continue on in our narrative. And in doing that, it proves to us and to everyone that is around us as we are continuing on and expressing verbally those doubts that we have. It shows the life-changing propensity of the narrative that we're in the middle of. Because it's changed our lives so much that even when we doubt, we're going to continue to let it shape us. So what I want to say is that this consistent doubting, if we employ consistent doubt upon our beliefs, we're going to gradually work ourselves into this position where we realize that no, we don't know anything for certain. For 100% empirically, we have no idea. It's just not there. We've doubted, if we begin to doubt so much, we begin to separate those beliefs that we have. Remember how I defined belief earlier? The insistence that we empirically know something, whether or not we can prove it. If we doubt so much, we begin to separate those beliefs from our identity, because we have to suggest, no, I'm not sure. They begin to distance themselves a little bit from us. And we begin to become more tied up in our faith, which is the narrative that we're a part of. Something happens when we get to this point. We get in this place where we're no longer at risk from people around us who have opposing viewpoints. We're no longer at risk from them, meeting them and talking to them and the things they say, beginning to dismantle our sense of self because it's chipping away at our identity and our beliefs. This process, Peter Rollins calls the process of confronting our monstrosity. Let me explain that a little bit. It sounds kind of weird. Now, what Rollins is trying to say by using the word monstrosity is that when we believe something so severely, when we're holding so tightly to it, when we meet somebody with an opposing viewpoint, somebody who's the way that they think, the things that they believe conflict inherently with ours, when we meet somebody like that, they're threatening our identity because our beliefs are tied into ourself. So the way that we respond to them is violently, not physically violently, but psychologically and spiritually violently. We shut ourselves off. We have to convince them that we're right and that they're not. Otherwise, our sense of self is gone. That is where we become monsters, because we're holding so firmly to these beliefs that we're attacking everyone around us who doesn't believe the same way. And in those attacks, becoming the thing that we wish never to be. But if we begin to exercise doubt on our beliefs and begin to separate those from ourselves while still maintaining their importance, I don't want to minimize their importance at all. When we exercise doubt and begin to separate those from ourselves, when we meet others with imposing viewpoints from ours, their viewpoints do no longer threaten us because we're guided by a narrative. We're guided by this thing that we have immersed ourselves in, no matter what evidence or proof gets thrown at it. And when we meet somebody like that, in that kind of state, we no longer have to fight against them to hold on to our beliefs. But instead, we can open ourselves up to them and say, hey, you believe this and I believe this. Tell me why you believe this. And we can exchange these things and we can share with each other. Because you're not a threat to me. And in that moment, in that kind of atmosphere, that's what creates trust. That's what creates relationship. That's why we're here. So because of all this, I suggested at the beginning of this talk that we begin to work towards making this thing we call doubt something of a spiritual discipline. Now, I know it sounds weird to put doubt on the same level as like prayer or fasting, which I don't really want to do. But what I want to say is that we need to work on separating our beliefs from ourselves and realizing that no, we can't know these things for certain. We need to realize that doubt is not the enemy of what we're doing. Doubt is a neutral because it's always here. It always is present. Now, the way that we use that doubt, the way that we employ that doubt, that defines whether it's good or bad. I'm going to read something else from Mother Teresa. She wrote this a little bit later. Now, as she was going through this process and as she was working in India, and as she was doubting so severely, she would have constant conversations with this guy who was mentoring her. He was a man named Father Nooner. Eventually, this priest brought up Christ's suffering on the cross to her and compared her situation to it. He said something along the lines of, "Look at the way Christ felt abandoned on the cross. You're feeling exactly that same way." And I want to suggest that in that abandonment, you have tied yourself in a very almost mystical way to the person of Christ. You are sharing with his brokenness at the most crucial point in his life. But not only are you sharing with the brokenness of Christ and your abandonment and that lack of God that you feel, but you are in such a place that you are sharing with everyone around you who is also abandoned. Those people who you're serving, who are the outcasts, the least of civilization, those who have been abandoned the most, you were tied to them intrinsically because of this doubt you've been feeling. So, after Mother Teresa heard this, she wrote this. "For the first time in 11 years, I have come to love the darkness. For I believe now that it is a part, a very, very small part of Jesus' darkness and pain on earth. Today I feel a really deep joy. More than ever, I surrender myself to him. Yes, more than ever, I am at his disposal." So that's where I'm going to leave us. I want to ask if we've come to love our own darkness like she did. Does our darkness serve to help shape and refine the story of our lives? Does it thrust us into lives of relentless commitment to our narrative? That narrative that is the mission of Christ.